grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody and welcome to episode 296 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host, coming at you from Austin, Texas. Our guest tonight, also from Austin, Texas, but due to COVID and the like, we're on via Skype instead of in person. However, we're going to have a great, great conversation with our guest tonight, the author of the great new book, Fork This Life, Volume 1. The amazing Ryan Rutan is on the show. He is the community director of Cynac Red Team, which is a group of white hackers that actively do digital penetration for companies, things like that. So I cannot wait to talk with him. I have a special thanks to listeners, Mr. and Mrs. Dodd out in the Phoenix, Arizona area. Some very good friends of mine who just got married, who sent me this sweet custom bottle of wine. So thank you guys. That will be enjoyed probably shortly after air, as well as a great, great thank you to our guest from last week. The great Stephen Myers. He does not lie when he says he will send you DVDs. He sent me 2 DVDs in the mail. So, yeah, go out, check things out over there, folks, at thepump.org. The things that they are doing over there at the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation is absolutely amazing. Some really cool hypotheses about how the Great Pyramid was built. So go by, check that stuff out. Please do not forget, our podcast is brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. If you're a fan of podcasting like I am, want to start up a show for yourself, your friends, family, fun, church, school, business, whatever, stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. That is all we do, is help people brand podcasts, help people learn to run the tech for their podcasts, help them out with learning to be an extemporaneous speaker, a better host, how to book guests. One-on-one private consultation is what we do over there. Give us a shout. We can definitely hook you up. Everything from specialists in the area of tech and editing to branding people, marketing people, people to teach you how to do social media, all kinds of fun stuff. PodcastCadet.com is the website that you want to go to. Dudes20 is the code that you want to use. Once again, our great guest this evening, Ryan, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Hey, Chris, how's it going? No, doing well. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, welcome to your first appearance on Dudes and Beer. I have been trying to find somebody who lives in the world of the hacker for a long, long time. And it's a guiding principle on my show that I don't just find random people to have these conversations with, much like when listeners kept requesting, please do a show on secret societies. I was like, I can't just have random people on to talk about secret societies. And lo and behold, we came across a professor who taught a class on it. So it's like when you can actively find somebody in that field, you have such an incredible opportunity for conversation and to really, really dig the rabbit holes deep as far as where things are going, what things are happening. Like we were talking about before the show began, Ryan, the field of hacking is kind of like the field of SEO. It's nebulous. It is constantly changing. So what was it that first brought you into the world of computing?
Oh, well, it's a pretty fun story. In fact, I mean, I would say it's to a point where growing up in small town Texas was a big part of it. I've lived in Texas my whole life. I've bounced around quite a bit of the cities here. But when I was growing up, you know, it was always an element of, you know, wanting to pick and tear things apart, like what made things, you know, click. I mean, I think I've torn apart my fair share of VCRs and DVD players and, and even computers when I was like under the age of 10, you know, and yeah, it was that curiosity that kind of got me in trouble a lot. But then, you know, when I started realizing, oh, I could start doing this for fun, you know, building my first computer, writing my first computer program, you know, and then I started realizing just like, you know, a lot of people that are in this, I guess in this industry right now, like realized at an early age, there's some things that people understand that others don't. And when you start seeing that, you're like, oh, yeah, this is, makes me feel special. This makes me feel unique and different. And then, you know, I feel my life has been a cavalcade of opportunities that have just magically appeared. Some cases very early on in life, some things that some people wouldn't even experience until much later in life, just because I was happened to be the person that had the right knowledge at the right time.
Yep.
You know, so it's, you know, it kind of all started back then when I would say when I was 7 or 8 years old, and then went rampant all the way through high school. And, you know, I kind of took an abnormal tact, if you will, to the professional world. And then, you know, and that's kind of where everything started. But again, what I would consider, you know, hacking knowledge today was just curiosity back then, which was, hey, I see something I can fiddle with. I'm going to, whether or not it was the right thing to do or what the right way was supposed to be done, you know, you could do it, you know,
yeah,
it was,
yeah.
You know, so I thought that was that curiosity, which was probably the big piece. So,
you know, it's interesting. I have another podcast, Talking Sound, that is all about my AV industry. And even I myself now own a guitar pedal modification company, and it all started with me dumpster diving and finding old radios and taking them apart, things like that. So whenever you talk about kind of the same kind of thing, being interested in the circuitry first and how it operated and trying to build your own computer, things like that, I am like, that is total kindred spirit moment for me. That is how I came to my beloved industry. And I think what you were saying, where having that knowledge at an early age put you at an advantaged position. And I've always heard the phrase, you know, yes, the right place at the right time, but you have to be prepared when that time comes.
Absolutely.
It does you no good to be in the right place at the right time if you are not the person with the solution. And to be able to be the person with the solution at that young of an age. Like I remember my microcomputer applications teacher. Once we got to past the point of touch typing, because my hands are just so entirely huge, they're larger than a keyboard. So for me, touch typing was rough. But once we got past that first 6 weeks, I had the same computer. I had the same programs at home. I was like a mini teacher's aide in the class. Like I ran around helping other kids after I was done with my work in 20 minutes, you know?
So I had a different experience with that. I had a keyboarding class where, you know, my mother is a paralegal, has been her whole life. So I was always in awe at her typing really fast. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to do that one day. And I remember my freshman year in high school, I took a keyboarding class required in high school. And, you know, the goal for many was to like type 60 words a minute by the end of the year or whatever.
Yeah.
I was typing that with three fingers. And so I was trying to incorporate. But again, like once I figured out how to do all the fingers, I was doing 110, 120. And the teacher was just like, I need you to stop typing so fast. You're making people around you self-conscious.
Yeah, you're making them intimidated. Yeah, you're intimidating your classmates now. And like when you first started down that road, what was it that I guess really clicked with you? Because I know for me with electronics, it was fiddling with things and making something different out of what existed. Like,
yeah, I mean, I would say a lot of that, like when I started, I would say probably most of it was just because me being a kid that didn't want, you know, I knew that I shouldn't, you know,
yeah.
I mean, the VCRs I took apart were not at parental request. Consented.
I remember getting in huge trouble for dismantling my mom's, her blow dryer. Uh-huh. On a Sunday afternoon and putting it back together. I mean, it didn't work anymore, but I put it back together. She wasn't too happy on Monday morning when she went to go get ready for work.
I'd always have extra screws, and I always told people I made it better.
That's right.
More efficient.
That's right. So. Did it better than it was designed.
Yeah. But I would say it started with that for sure. Mm. I mean, when I started getting into software development, I think that's where everything kind of went into overdrive. You know, my mother had gotten a magazine, I think it was Byte or to be honest, I forget what magazine it was, but it had sample basic programs in it. And, you know, oh, I would sit there and type, you know, these lines. I had no idea what I was doing. I just was typing. And when I got it to run, I was like, oh, here's a picture of a Statue of Liberty or whatever. And then I would go and say, oh, what happened if I change this? And I changed this. And then I started seeing, oh, I can make this thing my own. And I think that was the part that really kind of realized it's like, I wasn't bound by my physical limitations, like tools or anything like that. I could just create. I could change a character on a screen and I could have a completely net new product. And so that was something I think that kind of just went wildfire with me, especially as I started getting to higher level languages, you know, going into the high school. I think by the time I graduated, I had three or four professional languages under my belt at that point.
Now, when you say languages, explain that to the audience, because not everybody, I mean, I work a lot of big tech conferences. I grew up in the age of the floppy disk, you know, and watched things move to the world of the CD and now into solid state. You know, back when you had a turbo button that took you up to 2 megabytes.
33 hertz to 66 hertz.
Yeah, man. Yep. That way you could get your hardcore gaming done. Yeah. So, for your Prince of Persia and the like.
In the book, actually, which is really funny because that is a very interesting moment in time. So.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I graduated high school in 1993. So
I was only 4 years behind you.
Those moments were magical. I remember, my seventh grade class was maybe the second at our junior high that had been made to take a computer class. Mm-hmm. And we were all working in basic things like that. And I remember making something with Gumby that like his hands moved left and right and his eyes moved the opposite direction and Gumby flashed in different colors. Like, mm-hmm. And it was cool. I could not do that again to save my life. Like, no way.
Now it's pretty much a web page that does that for you. Well, so it's all good.
And a lot of people don't realize, I guess, going back to the question was, what are these languages of which you speak?
So I guess my first language was BASIC. And I would consider myself at the time when I first started it, like it was just experimental. Like I was didn't really know, have any formal understanding of what I was doing beyond that. Oh, I changed this and that happens. But I got really good at it. And I kind of caught it, I guess. I would admit that at the time I didn't have a full understanding of what I was doing, but I was really good at affecting change. I could do something. And then from there, QBasic was a natural extension. After that, I had Turbo Pascal, was my next big formal language that I used, and then C++. And what these languages are is, at the end of the day, computers all understand things. Most computers, as in large majority of them, understand things in ones and zeros. So it's, you know, it's how do you get to that ones and zeros? Everything that you type, like your keyboard, the operating system, the software that you install is all about converting something from human form into computer form.
Yeah.
So at some point it gets down to these languages are just a way, an intermediate form for you to write programs so that you can kind of have a mental model of understanding how to organize your program. And then it will take that program and compile it down and make it to where it makes sense for the computer to run it.
Yep.
And so each language has their own benefits. In the scenarios that I provided, QBasic and BASIC were like the primordial ooze, if you will, at the time of the stuff that I was familiar with. They were predated with like Fortran and Ada and all these other systems that are back then, which again were much more complex and even still in use today in some government agencies. But when you get into procedural level programming like Turbo Pascal or object oriented like C++, it's a different mental model of how you view and represent your program and expand it. The hardest part about writing a program is not version 1.0. It's how do you keep it from having bugs every time you add new stuff to it.
How do you keep it from partially corrupting the code that you had there previously?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I only know this, like I said, I have not programmed since like seventh, eighth grade. After that came the C prompt and the world was a different thing. you know, but I know some of this just from my experience with coding WordPress, that kind of stuff. And being able to finally get to the point many years later of and teaching myself to get to the point of being able to look into that CSS code, being able to look into the PHP code. And those things control different elements of the website, you know. So being able to see that kind of stuff, see what it's doing, see what it's called, what values I need to change the size of text, the color, all that kind of stuff. And it's kind of along the same lines where there's CSS, PHP, HTML. Those are all languages in and of themselves.
Yep. Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, so like, you know, when I think of programming, like even to this day, like I make the joke in the book is that I kind of laugh at HTML a bit. I remember thinking about it going, that's not a programming language or that's not a whatever. And because I was always comparing it to Turbo Pascal and things like that. And in hindsight, like my career has been defined more by the ability for me to adapt languages into a web application, into certain problems into a web interface. Yeah. And it's been probably my most indispensable skill. So like, yeah, when I was
to make it HTML friendly.
Yeah. And when I was coming out of high school, actually one of my unique experiences was, you know, I was growing up in a small town in Kerrville, Texas. Mm. And, you know, at the time, they really didn't have a lot of internet options there, if any. And there was a local BDS that was there that a guy had moved into town. One of my friends had worked with him and, you know, kind of gotten in on the inside and was a sysop there, kind of helping things out. And I kind of got into that crowd. And then it kind of became an opportunity. It's like, hey, we should turn this BBS into an internet. And, you know, at 15 years old, you're like, okay, I'm about to help support or help, you know, sell, help do what, you know, thrust into a sales capacity, into a tech support capacity, into building computer. I mean, it was like just being thrown into it. And ironically, at the time, you know, I also was the software manager for one of the biggest places in town to buy software. So it was one of those weird positions like, okay, I'm 15 years old or 16 years old. And I'm sitting at the heartbeat of where people are getting online and buying computer software.
Wow.
And it was very weird to be there at that position. It's like, hey, you know, you could come meet me during my work hours at work. And after work, I would go to your house and fix your computer. You know, it was kind of like a weird thing to do, you know, going through, you know, only as a sophomore or even a junior in high school. So,
well, and just for those out there that may have gotten lost in the alphabet soup, BBS was an old school bulletin board system.
Yes.
And man, I remember going, I lived in Houston and I remember going to like Video Central, was one of the places that carried the little rack of, local magazines that had the, like, you know, it was just a listing of bulletin board systems, like dial into this number. And it was the beginning of chat rooms. I remember swapping files with people, swapping games with people, all kinds of, and you had to be able to make things like flash and do stuff to get the right access with a bulletin board manager, you know, like, cause if you were just some scab that was out there, just trading files, it was different than if you were somebody that knew a little bit of code. What was that like for you just being the head of a bulletin board system at that point? Because even now, I mean, that kind of translates almost directly into social media nowadays.
It does. I mean, I would say that from my perspective, I'm always really honest about, like, you know, accepting what I've done and what, you know, I just happen to be in a good position. So my position was, I was in the room. I was on the inner circle. The guy who ran the BBS was the primary sysop. One of my friends that I worked with at the time, he was more of a sysop than I was. But at the end of the day, we all had administrative access. We could all, help out, kick people off, free up lines. You know, it was really interesting time to, you know, you see when you have this BBS was being run out of the guy's garage. And, you know, this guy had like, I think 48 lines or 36 lines of, you know, pot lines coming in.
Wow.
And in his garage. And it was just like, you couldn't even walk in there without hearing the squelching going on from the modems. It was just always, always someone was logging in. So it was maddening to a certain degree, but it was, you know, but it was really interesting because it was, what was funny was that at the time, like today, internet's almost like a utility, right? As much as it isn't, it is a ubiquitous element for most.
Oh, absolutely.
And back then it really wasn't, being ahead of the game in my town, about having access to internet. You know, I remember the first website I went to, the first thing that helped me get out of doing homework at school. You know, there was a ton of really good stuff that was there, but again, no one knew about it. So no one, you know, and again, there wasn't very, very much out there to index and crawl. Like Google back then was like web crawler and Alta Vista maybe, or something like that. Yeah, like there wasn't a lot of stuff out there to crawl, and it wasn't as good as it is today. So you could be a dark part on the internet and not really, you know, your darkness was only because you just weren't linked anywhere.
You could just pop up, do stuff and go away. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't much of a trail at that point. Other than maybe the phone number on the other end that it dialed them from.
Correct. I mean, that's, like I said, you know, the interesting thing with VBS is what makes them different. Like, you know, today most people have some form of high speed internet. You know, there's not really very many people out there that still have modem squelching going on. But, back then you could log into a VBS such as, ours, and then you could kind of hop to another one from there. And it was basically you could, you know, and you were using our phone, this phone line, and it would use a connection to the other BBS, and you could kind of jump back and forth. So that was your way of kind of jumping around the world, if you will. But again, it was all based on phone lines and the ability for you to connect. There really wasn't an internet necessarily available at the time that they could readily use. So phone lines, when you're a BBS owner or everything, if you get a busy signal, people hate you. And you get people sit on there and squat and they're not doing anything. Like the most famous thing is they'll log on, download something, and they'll go to sleep, and you know, they'll be connected and they won't necessarily be disconnected until like someone tries to call them and call waiting hits or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Her mom picks up the phone trying to call grandma. God, man, I remember screaming, don't pick up the phone.
Yeah. Dang it.
I'm talking with people. Don't pick up the phone.
You don't have. It's like there's another level. It's people look at you like you're crazy. But I'm like, no, there was a time.
There was a time. and that's just it. I think that we really, in this modern day and age, take so much of what we have for granted. And I think that we're probably the last generation there to really remember the gap. Mm-hmm. Really remember the day of 8-bit video gaming.
Yep.
You know, like I remember a couple, probably about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I was at my mom's house in Katy, and one of my nephews ran across my old Sega Master System.
Oh, wow.
And they're like, they were like, what's this? And I was like, oh, that was my jam, dude. Like, you come home and play your Xbox. That's what I came home and played. Oh, it's an Atari. I was like, no, it's a Sega. You know, it was, they were different than Nintendo. Nintendo had a lot of family games, but Sega had a lot of arcade games. And that's what I was an arcade gamer. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, what was your favorite one? And I was like, boom, Shinobi.
It was Shinobi and Afterburner.
Yep.
Those are your two right there.
That's
Top Gun and Ninja Gaiden just couldn't cut the mustard.
No. And it was, he was like, oh, let me try it. And he passed, he was going, he passed somebody up and went to go back and just spinning against the wall like, oh, I can't go back? No, dude. It is forever forward. There is no back. And then he died. And then he started all over, and he's like, I had to start all the way back at the beginning? I'm like, yeah. I think he tried it about 3-4 times full of regular lives before he was like, I'm done. I'm like, oh, come on, man. Let me show you how it's done. And went and beat the game. Like, within, I think I had like one life left, but it was pretty classy to know that 40 years later, I still had it.
No, like those are skills that never go away.
I know. It's like, wow, that's some insane muscle memory, man. And with that in mind, just thinking about muscle memories and, you know, what the progression of technology, what was it that brought you from the point of running BBSs, that kind of thing, to the point of running the CINAHC Red Team? And one of the largest conglomerates of white hat hackers out there.
So, I mean, I would say, my journey is definitely an element of a function of opportunity. So, when I left high school, I went to college at the time when my friend and I, who actually was my friend when we were doing the CSOP at the BBS in Kerrville, we went to the same college. We happened to find a friend that a guy that lived near us that in the same dorm or apartment, if you will, that was about to leave college, and he worked at an ISP there in Corpus Christi. And so we got in on there on the inner circle, another small team running a large ISP, a much larger one than the one in Kerrville. And, again, at that point we were given the opportunity, build websites, do sales, do networking, custom sidering of networks and setting up NAT firewalls. And again, things that, here, you want to do it, go do it. Fine. We'll pay you, really, really cheap money. But at the same time, it was a learning opportunity. And at that point, yeah. What's that?
No, I was just saying, yeah, that's been an incredible opportunity.
Yeah. So it was super fun, super nerdy. I mean, I picked up another four or five languages there. I got really, really obsessed with Perl at that time, which was my go-to for really just for fun tinkering. But from there, I really kind of earned my chops, and I was in college for a CS major. And, by the time, we'd already done database web applications and built them for customers and stuff like that. And I'm in college, they're like telling me to here, intro to databases, it got to a point where it was realizing that I was topping out from my college that I chose. And again, I chose my college because of the computer lab and because it just happened to be a college without any, kind of history. It was a brand new, fresh college. It had no kind of, legacy or any kind of thing. It was just go to school and that's it. And so I did that, I ended up dropping out of college with my friend. We both were, I think, I don't know if it was me. I'll just put it on me because I'm a little bit more of a cautious person. He was more cavalier than I was. But we had this opportunity at the end of 1999. Where we were like, well, our friend had just left the ISP and moved to Dallas, was making a lot of money. And he was like, well, we can do that too. And so we decided that, instead of telling our parents that we were going to do this, we waited for our lease to expire on our apartment and for the renewal for college to expire. And then we called and told them that, hey, we're going to be going to Dallas.
Hey, by the way, since we don't have a place to live anyway. Yeah.
Not doing that anymore. But we left. We in 99, I think at the time, I guess I was, 19 years old. My friend was 18 or 19 as well. And we went and got full, fully web programmer jobs, and we did that really well. I would say the first 2-3 months, I was very kind of cautious. I was like, I didn't realize know what I didn't know, if that makes sense. I felt like I was like, in a sea of sharks, whatever, but it came clear after 2 or 3 months that I knew more, if not, a lot more than most of the people there. And same with my friend. And so we worked our way up the ranks and did the .com thing for a while. And then, everything came crashing down, in 2000 or 2000, I guess 2001, something like that. And I just got to the point where like I was making a lot of money, building a lot of really good things. I mean, I worked at Enron as a contractor during that time for about 6-7 months, doing a lot of really crazy stuff. So again, it's hindsight 2020. It's like, oh my gosh, yeah, of course that was going to happen. But these are all opportunities that were just made because I was in the right place, right time, right decision, whatever.
Yeah.
When it got done, I decided, I got tired of exchanging my personal life for money. If that makes sense. Like I could get paid more, but because I didn't have a degree, I was conscious of that. I didn't, I kind of knew that it was a sore spot. So I went back to college. I decided to went to UT of Austin here in Austin, got a business degree there, fast tracked my way through it as I was clepping out of courses, taking, 15, 18 hours as much as I could to try to get out as fast as I could. And then again, joined on with a local company here in Austin, worked in IT for a while, building solutions, building out architectures and, building out applications, and ultimately made my way to a Silicon startup, remotely, working remotely here in Austin since like 2011, I think. And then, long story short is I did developer evangelism. So again, I love talking. I have a big theater background, so I enjoy getting on stage, performing and whatnot. So evangelism is an actual industry where you kind of, you know, run communities where you inform people about these are the ways in which you can be successful, and this is how to use our products better and things like that. So I ran a really powerful developer community at a company. And then when I saw the opportunity for Synac, which again is, it's really an opportunity to go back to my curious side, which is I want to go and be the mouthpiece, the loudest person in the room to talk about the Synac Red Team, talk about ethical hacking, talk about opportunities, make opportunities for other hackers. I was like, this is my jam. This is me coming home, if you will.
Well, so. And you mentioned a key word there that is far from a buzzword. I think it's a term that's used far too frequently with people, and that is ethical hacker. Explain to us what that is, because not a lot of people know what a white hat hacker is, what an ethical hacker is, all that kind of stuff. So explain that to them.
I think the one thing I really have enjoyed about this job, if nothing else, is it gives me an opportunity to use my strengths to really promote this industry. Ethical hacking is an essential part of what we need as a society going forward. There's no way that we are going to be safe and secure in the digital age without a strong ethical hacking base. But the difference is when you're a hacker, there's a lot of stigma. You know, you think of, you know, dark room, you know, hoodie, no light, pale skin, whatever. And while some of those may still be true for ethical hacking, it's the biggest difference is one of my colleagues actually used this term. It says, think bad, do good. And the idea for an ethical hacker to find the vulnerabilities on websites and systems before the bad people do and report them responsibly so that the companies have a chance to fix them. In doing so in a way that financially rewards them. Some people might hear the bug bounty is a term that people use, and it's a very popular model right now with ethical hackers, which is, companies pay upfront to have hackers come to them, or companies pay to have hackers come to them, find bugs in their site. And when they find really good stuff, they pay out, you know, usually pretty good rates. Depending on the severity, if you will, of it. And that money that is used to create that money that pays those ethical hackers is used, the return on investment is made from the opportunity cost of litigation. Like how much does it cost for my company to pay and you did not properly secure this private data, so that's $2 million.
Yep.
Okay, so that I could either spend $2 million or I can spend $1 million and pay a bunch of people to find the bugs beforehand and reduce my likelihood for litigation and overall whatever, right? And so it's not always that simple of a math, but again, it's that by me paying up front and managing that security risk up front, it's more responsible to the data, it's more responsible to the customer. And again, it's just trying to solve problems before they are found.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it really is kind of like a lot of what I do. It's fire control. It's stomping on embers before they become fires.
Pretty much. Yeah,
you know,
I would say that's it.
And it's really kind of learning to expect and prepare for the worst case scenario. And try to secure your system as much as possible. I know it's a ongoing process with any system, but what's your average time to test a system like that, to start finding weaknesses, that kind of stuff?
I mean, so from the industry, the most common is a 2-week pen test. So companies will sign on to have systems. Have people like, you know, audit their systems or engage with them. And depending on the agency that you use or the service you use, that 2 or 1 week can flex. Usually what people do is an element of technology plus human is what my company focuses on. So we have a lot of scanners and technology that helps our red teamers be a little more efficient and more effective while they're scanning. So like if they were to come at a blind completely, then the idea is that our platform is giving them better visibility into the target so they can actually find the good stuff without having to try as hard.
Yeah.
And so that's where our kind of secret sauce comes in. But 2 weeks is usually the open window. But, you know, to be honest, one of the things that's really fun to watch is when you see a target go live and you see the number of connections just start popping, the number of researchers connecting and scanning and, you know, testing things out. And then, you know, sometimes even in the first hour, you see reports start coming in, you know, found this, you know. And, you know, if you get, you know, up more than five reports in the first hour, you know that it's going to be a brutal 24 hours because it's, you know, if stuff, people are finding stuff that quick, that means it's usually going to be pretty pervasive.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had the privilege of working a couple of hacker cons, things like that. I just saw the thing on y'all's website about y'all being at Black Hat Con. And not a lot of people realize, like I said, what white hat hacking is, what ethical hacking is, what black hat hacking is. So for you to be able to make that distinction for us is fantastic. Cause like you said, it really does help get rid of a lot of the stigma. I mean, you grew up at the same time as me. There's a great classic movie called War Games that was based on a lot of the concepts of the old phone freak himself. But to start getting into that a little bit, what was it that first brought you to the point of wanting to write your book, Fork This Life, Volume 1?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of this, I think a lot of it was me turning 40 was a big motivator. You know, I had, you know, when I was young, I had these lofty goals of things I wanted to do. I had, you know, I always kind of framed my life by the movies that I liked or the movies that inspired me. Renaissance man, or the concept of a Renaissance man, a person who, sure, you know, really enjoys different aspects from all different parts of life, is something that I thought was very appealing. When I was in high school and stuff, I never really thought that I would be a writer because I hated English so much. But I had a really awesome English teacher who really drove me to the point of insanity to be better. And so now at this point, you know, I was like, well, you know, I'm going to try writing a book. You know, I did in 2015, I did a children's book. Actually, it was my first foray.
Oh, wow.
I was actually working on an IoT project. To build, it's actually still something I'm working on, but basically the concept is a little device that parents put in their house called the Polar Port, and it has a little LED matrix in it that syncs with your phone. You tell the kid that, hey, this is the naughty nice meter for the real time naughty nice meter for the North Pole. And the kids do something bad, you can flick your phone, and next thing you know, the kids see the actual thing drop. And I thought it was a really cool idea, and I've got a rough prototype here, but I wanted to write a book about it because, again, the device doesn't mean anything without a story behind it. So yeah. A friend of mine who's went to UT, is an AV guy as well, is a really awesome artist. I went to high school with him. I worked with him and his daughter to not just illustrate it, but also, you know, practiced, you know, they helped translate it into Spanish and just
cool.
Did the whole process. And then I was like, you know, that was fun, but I want to try a full length book, you know, something that's more than 30 or, you know, 20, 30 pages. So.
Sure. And what was that process like for you? I know I myself have not taken pen to page necessarily in a long time. I know a couple of authors that have gone out and started doing very well for themselves. But What were some of the struggles that you came up against as you started, like you said, kind of stretching your world into novel writing?
I think the biggest part was getting started, because the world was my oyster, right? It was like, where do I begin? Mm. And ironically enough, I just released a bunch of blog posts I called Hacking My First Fiction Novel on my website. That's literally me breaking down this story, but it's, the thing I actually did was what inspired me was actually Ernest Cline, to be honest.
Okay.
So I had picked up his book, Ready Player One, and I read it all while I was on vacation. And again, it was just, to me, it just was the perfect tone. I had never read a book at the time that felt like it was, in that tone that resonated how I thought, you know, and the way that my brain kind of parses words and brings things together. And I was like, oh, you can actually write like this. And so that it compelled me. It's like, oh, well, this, I found my voice. I can do this. So, I read his next book, Armada, and I was like, you know what? I was convinced I can do it. So I literally have his book Armada. I had it on my desk for almost 2 years, but I would look at it and I'd say, okay, well, his book is about 400 pages, so mine's going to need to be about 400 pages. This needs to be 26, you know, whatever. So I was like breaking it down as to, you know, task lists of things I need to do. And then I wanted to come up with something that I was really passionate about. And I can find a reason to talk about just about anything. But for me, what I felt was an untold story, or something that I think we take for granted too much, is this era of analog to digital that took place in the mid 90s.
Yeah.
And that was something that, again, I felt my life was in a very weird position where I was able to sit at the flashpoint of change on so many different things, that I really wanted to, in a way, move on and say, let me chronicle my stories, my ideas, my experiences that I've had, my relationships that I've had. Let me just close the chapter on my first 40 years of life and put it in a book and kind of let that go. And that was, so I kind of took that. I you know, looked at pretty much every story that I had inside me, and I put them all together, took all the experiences. I broke them apart into all the different characters. There's no one character in the book that's actually based on any one person in my life. Each character is an amalgam of different elements. And then, yeah, I just started, you know, bringing things together and the way I build software, building, you know, using Google Docs and integrations and shortcuts and time hacks, and that's kind of where I am.
Well, and the one thing that I liked about this, and I'm still not done reading it yet, but the one thing that I liked is that this is a pretty age-friendly book. You know,
I would say so. I'm not a big fan of vulgarity for the most part.
Sure.
Like, you know, and the most, like, I would say that there are some elements though. I'm definitely no saint.
Sure. There are a couple things in there, but you know,
I try to keep everything above board because really my life is like that. I try to do good as much as I can. And in reality, like, to pay tribute to these people that I really hold dear. Like, I, you know, back in the day, I think what's really important is that there wasn't a lot of stuff to read. There weren't a lot of experts. There wasn't a lot of exchange of information back then. So usually the things you learned was from the people you met.
Yeah.
Or the things that you downloaded from people that, you know, whatever. And it's, and I don't think the world would be in a place like it is today if we didn't have people willing to share their curiosity and be, you know, and share their knowledge the way it did and happened back then. Because it's, you know, and that's what the book is kind of meant to do, is meant to kind of pay tribute to that. Cause I felt like, you think of the 90s, you think of the football teams. Everyone talks about the Dallas Cowboy era or different things like that.
Yeah.
With this was like the, I would consider the unsung heroes. It's like the things that tech support people had to deal with back then versus what they had to deal with now. You know, people being thrust into positions where there really was no backstop. You were oftentimes untrained and figuring things out on the fly.
Yeah. And ill prepared.
Yeah. And, you know, there really was no course for it. Now there's 17 million courses and you can get trained in 18 million different languages or whatever. But it's like back then it was like, you know, if you're from small town Texas or small town Corpus Christi, you know, whatever, and you are trying to do a professional element, like there really wasn't a lot of stuff for you besides your support network of people, and staying in connection with them was, you know, large in part the technology you were trying to support. So it's kind of like a catch 22.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even, you know, flashing back to those days of the mid 90s, that kind of stuff, when CD-ROMs really first started taking over, there was growth, but at the same time, a lot of that growth was very proprietary within systems and families of systems. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of, let's say, like, every computer on the shelf over there made by four different manufacturers are all using an AMD motherboard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't a whole lot of that going on necessarily. And I think now there is much more of, I think, a spirit of collaboration and innovation between companies. Especially whenever you look at things like NVIDIA, that kind of stuff. The way, I mean, I used to work the NVIDIA conference every year, and that was one of my favorite 4-day geek outs every year. That was my
go-to video card for so long.
Oh, man. I've still got some, and not too long ago ran across my buddy who builds systems for me, got a hold of me and was like, hey, you may want to check this guy out on eBay. And it was a dude with a bunch of 1080 mining cards.
Oh.
For $100 each. I was like, yeah, I'll take a couple of those. So, yeah, now my systems all have like one of those and a 1080. It's pretty wrong. to look at my Adobe system and be like, oh, wow, there's like 54 gigs of RAM dedicated to that. That's insane. And to know, like we were saying earlier, back in the day, for me to play Prince of Persia right, I had to bump up to 2 megabits.
Yeah.
You know, so to see that kind of world unfold within the last 30 years, I think has been really amazing. And to know where we're coming now with the world of quantum computing, and even the processors that are coming out now, are really, really exciting. What are some of the things that y'all are seeing, in your world as far as, the curve with hacking and systems and languages? I know a lot of the conferences I work, a lot of the advice that the panels give is go learn Python. Like, we need server managers. Like, apps are cool, but we need people that know these like hardcore base languages that run all of it, you know. And it's kind of interesting because in the physical world, it's very much the same thing where there is a return to, we need infrastructure jobs. Like, our bridges are falling down. We need people to fix them. We denied that. And it's interesting to kind of see that happening in the digital world as well.
No, I mean, yeah, I think that from the hacking side of things, I think what's really funny or sad is probably the better way to put it is, you know, when I was doing software development back, you know, active software development as like an engineer releasing things in 2011, you know, I was familiar with the OWASP Top 10, which is I forget what OWASP stands for, but it's Web Application Security Project, Open Web Application Security Project, I think. But it's like a guideline for, hey, these are the most popular things that people, that hackers are finding, that when vulnerabilities are reported. And so if you have limited resources, you know, these are the top 10 things that you should focus on. Make sure that, you know, you've covered on your application. And when I took an 8-year sabbatical into the marketing developer relations, you know, evangelism realm, I didn't have to focus on them too much. But when I came back in 2019, I noticed that the list had only changed by 2, which to me, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying that's pretty remarkable that it did not really budge that much.
Yeah. And what's sad about that, though, in that in 8 years, the problem is that in that 8 years, the tooling from what used to be, oh, you have to be an elite hacker to pull this thing off, you know, in 2011, like you had to know how, you know, you had to know all the bits and bytes and every element of it. Right.
Yeah.
And you had to be something relatively, you know, has their game squarely in place.
Mm-hmm.
By the time 2019 comes around, it can be anyone that can type in a command and hit enter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what's happening is the tooling for the bad actors is getting exponentially better every day. The amount of code that's being released every day by the industries that are out there is growing exponentially every day. But the number of people that are manned to defend against the bad actors, to defend against the code that could have faults in it, is not. And so that's where, you know, you're talking about people to man the servers. You know, there's a big focus on orchestration, people trying to automate management, build pipelines, deployment cycles, things like that. But again, those are just more software that has to be tested and secured and managed to make sure that it's not vulnerable. The last thing you want is a hacker to be able to, you know, infiltrate a development pipeline or whatnot and actually be able to inject an entirely different website into your build.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no. And I've had that happen. I've had that happen where, and it was, man, I think my .com for Austin Hot Mods, my pedal modification company, may have lapsed for like 8 hours, something like that. And I was like, oh my God, I was supposed to renew that. And I went and renewed
it. Got your domain. Yeah.
And I went and it was like this, well, I mean, it was a bunch of hot mods. Let's just say that. Yeah. It was like, whoa, that took no time. Holy crap.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons why they have, like, I mean, you've got domains now, like they'll give you like, this is your, you know, 30-day warning, 10-day warning. We're about to do it. We will do it. We promise you we're going to do it.
Yeah.
It's because of that. It is so easy to monitor that stuff. You know, all they do is they go to, you know, they go to Google, they find out what sites are getting traffic.
Yeah.
And they find their domains. They look for the ones that filter it by the ones that are expiring. And then if no one picks it up, they go and buy it. And then they steal all your clicks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's
absolutely,
you know, it's a sad science. But again, it's one of those things where it's like, if you, what I just described is not something that requires a bean counter or someone that it's something that requires 1 to 2 hours of work to write a script to do it. And then after that, it's 5 seconds to run it every day.
Yeah. And I have seen people live, and I'm not going to name names. If you're out there listening, you know who you are. Because I was wowed by this. I have quite literally seen engineers that I know at conferences just scanning for Wi-Fi signals that are weak and then running an algorithm that just breaks them. And then they're using that person's Wi-Fi.
Yep.
And it's just too little, like you said, just, you know, like MS run commands, just two little command windows open, you know. One, they type in their command for their little program and it just starts popping up Wi-Fi signals. And then the other one, they just go and enter in the Wi-Fi signal and it starts penetrating it. It's like, whoa. That's wild. And I remember when I first moved to Austin, I worked a very small HackerCon. I want to say it was like a UT-based group that was doing a very small thing. But I saw a guy hack into a home computer through a Bluetooth nightlight. Because the home computer was tied into the same network. And it was like, whoa, like, that's deep. So, whenever you see things like that happen in front of your face, it's a wow moment, you know, and it really does. Like, I'm not going to say I don't have an Amazon Alexa. I have an Amazon Alexa. I got one as a gift to show that I worked. I unplug it when I ain't using it. I'll tell you that.
Very smart move.
So what is the average person's exposure to things like this, Ryan? What does the average person have to worry about?
I think the biggest thing is when it comes to their exposure, I think it has to do a lot with their own personal choices. Mm. So, you know, the biggest thing that people need to realize is that, you know, if you go to like your banking institution, right, you would expect your banking institution to go through thorough security, security checks, audits, scans and things like that.
Sure.
Chances are that it does. But if you use the same username and password that you use at some mom and pop pet food store, you know, the same email, the same password, and that site is not security tested and vetted, and they can get a dump of all the usernames and passwords from there, that becomes just open season on that set of credentials. So I think that in the end of the day, like if you're not using a password manager to create unique usernames, unique logins for all of the websites and web properties that you use, you're at extreme risk because the law of large numbers, you know, if you go and look at all the sites that have ever been, you know, dumped and, you know, dumped to the dark web. There's sites that you can put in your credentials to see, hey, has my email ever been compromised? You know, if you've been using that email for more than 5 years, chances are it's there at least once.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I forget, who it was that I heard speaking at a conference one time, but was giving the plain numbers of like the last really, really big hack that went down a few years ago. And he was like, if you add up all the numbers of these major breaches that have happened, if you've got a social security number in the United States, you have been compromised. Like that's just how the numbers work out, you know? Because there were more social security numbers than that were compromised in it. So yeah, it's a foregone conclusion, I think, that it's going to happen. I tell people, with podcasts and with websites, the day it happens to you, consider it a badge of honor and then get to really working real hard, you know?
I mean, I don't know if you saw just the other day, 28 million licenses, the DMV was hacked.
Oh, wow.
And so, and here in Texas, so really? 28 million driver's licenses, you know, information, your personal ID, driver's license, information is all, you know, was all stolen.
Or wow.
a data breach happened, rather, is a better way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, like that doesn't have your social in it, whatever. And again, like, but for any time that you use potentially a security question of what's your driver's license number or anything that has that information, or a lot of times websites have, oh, hey, put it, you know, trying to recover your password, give us your driver's license number and we'll send you, you know,
yep.
That right there is now a weak link, if you will, in that process. Yeah. So it doesn't take a lot. And again, it just, that's what stinks about this is that it's, you know, for all the advantages we get about having all these servers and technologies and things that come together, you know, it creates an exponential problem of, you know, you need to make sure that you're taking care of them. Otherwise, you're going to have the curious people that, you know, the next, or I wouldn't say the next generation, but two generations for me.
Yeah.
You know, of people who are like, oh, I can poke this and it can do this. Okay, great. You know, and hopefully the term ethical hacker outweighs a traditional hacker. Soon it becomes, becomes a badge of honor, becomes a something that is sought after, and we can grow that industry more to try to keep up with this deficit. But until that happens, like this is the world we live in, which is, you know, there's a couple of safeguards. If you could do like the top three things, you know, I think you're pretty good. And again, it's with the password managers that are out there, it's relatively easy and benign to create that stuff. But again, just some restraint on your end to be like, hey, do I really know who this person is? Should I click on this link?
And hey, folks, don't be number one. Yes. If you do not know the email, don't click it. I love my mom. Mom, I love you so much. If you're listening tonight, stop clicking links, man. Stop it. She wonders why she gets all these links and all these phone calls and stuff like that on social media and everything else. And I was like, I love you, but you're registered for AARP. Do you think that they did not sell your email address? The U.S. Post Office sells your email address. Like, that, just a little tip, folks, if you're planning on changing addresses, just tell all your debtors where you moved. Call them up and let them know. They'll send your next bill there. Don't fill out that change of address form. That is how you end up with junk mail in your mailbox before you even move in. That's addressed to you. Like, they've already customized the delivery of it before you even move in. It's crazy. So it's interesting for you to say that yes, quite literally, people are almost giving their security away. One of the things that we try to remind people of all the time, especially with social media platforms like that, if it's free, you are the product. You and your information, your opinions, whatever, you are the end product. So, like, guaranteed that information is being mined, sold to people, sold to advertisers, all that kind of stuff. So, and that's been shown numerous times. What advice would you give for somebody that wants to start following the path of a machine coder, of somebody that starts building these firewalls, that starts doing ethical hacking?
I mean, there's tons of stuff. I mean, the easiest thing to do is start with YouTube. I mean, there's
amen. Amen.
That is the place to learn everything.
I learned to read schematics and to code websites through Google.
There you go.
Just going and typing. That's it. Mm-hmm. Type in your question, hit enter, read.
Yep. But I would say starting with YouTube is definitely a good thing. Read up about like what ethical hacking is. Mm. Again, it's definitely an interesting area. When it comes to, again, when it comes to being an ethical hacker, the most traditional element is a red teamer, a person who is offensively minded to try to penetrate a system, an application or whatnot. I would usually say that, you know, like I said, you can start with a certification. There's a lot like Security Plus that are really kind of basic that'll get you started in the, does this feel right to my end? Again, it's not any practical knowledge around how to do penetration testing or whatnot, but it at least gets you into the mindset of, hey, am I capable or willing to augment my thinking to be in this space? Paranoia is a natural byproduct, sadly, of being in this area.
Paranoia and pure cynicism.
Yes, that too. Well, I think that's just IT in general. So, technology professionals in general. But yes.
Yeah, there is even amongst audio and video engineers, there's just a dour sense of humor.
Yeah. I would say start there with the certification pieces. And that's, again, just for you to test the waters. And again, it's not a really big investment. If you have a lot of skill, like if you're an application developer or you're a network operator, DevOps, something like that, and you want to give it a shot, I mean, there's a lot of ways that you can try it out. There's a lot of CTFs or capture the flag events that are always going on. There's a lot of public servers like Hack the Box, Try Hack Me, that you can go to, which again, they're the, think of them as, I call them computer puzzles. Like they stand up computers sure. with known flaws. And then if you can undermine the computer and find the flag that's digitally stored in the computer, then you win the puzzle, right? And the more of those that you can do, the more confidence you should have is like, hey, you know, I've got the skills to consider this. And then you can start going towards finding your discipline. Like usually if you're a developer of some sorts, you usually kind of come at it from either a blue side where you're hardening your code to be more secure. You could then pivot to the red side from there to about, I know how to write secure code, which means I also know how I used to not write secure code. So that's how I can make my red team attack, is looking for people who write code the way I used to. So again, there's a lot of ways to pivot it around, but again, it all starts with YouTube. There's tons of experts, I would say the thing I love about this community, and again, it's, is the fact that it is almost entirely meritocratic. And it's something that I think resonates with me very well, is that, you know, most companies don't care of, you know, whether you were a female or what country you're from when you get hacked. Like, that's not the first thing they ask. You know, I got hacked. Oh, crap. That's not, that, you know, that's.
Yeah,
that's
yeah. So, out of their mind. So where do you live again?
Exactly. So yeah. If you're able to do this skill, whether you're 14, 15, woman, man, or other, you United States citizen, Canadian, Israeli, wherever, right? Doesn't matter. Like, skill is skill. And that's what I love about this industry. The other thing I like about it are the people. As nuanced as many of the personalities are in this field, again, there are many of them. The one thing that I think unites everyone is this sense of sharing and sharing of that curiosity and that kindred spirit that that brings everyone together. There is a culture of, you know, I've seen it on many times, in, even inside the CINAHC Red Team, where, you know, a hacker's really, really close to you know, getting into something, but they just can't figure that last piece out. And then some people come in and say, oh, you should try this, this, and this. You know, one of them works and they get through, and it's the fact that, while they are competing against each other, trying to be the first to find these bugs to get paid out and whatever like that, they recognize that, you know, hey, I'm going to share a little bit of knowledge because I was where this guy was or where this girl was once. And, you know, so I really, really admire that about this industry. So again, getting into it, it requires a lot of passion and dedication, but if you can bring that and some skill, you have a lot of stuff that you can lean on to engage the community and get support.
And I guess for our last question, what was your favorite thing about writing Fork This Life Volume 1, and when will we get to see Volume 2?
Well, there's an Easter egg in the book if anyone wants to find it. That can help answer that question, the second part of that question. But in terms of me, I think the things that I enjoyed about it was the puzzle. I knew that there was a factory in the middle. Some on the far end of the right of it, there was a book that would come out of it, printed and with my name on it and everything, you know, with my words, my ideas. And I was at a starting point, and I had so many different paths to travel and to figure that out. And it was the fact that it was like, you know, throwing a lawn dart a million miles away, trying to hit a target and not knowing if you were going to make it or not. again, it was an ambitious goal. I had never written something this long. I was completely trying something brand new. I had written, you know, I write blogs all the time, but I had never really put together a project that required this much thought and this much passion, this much late night writing.
Yeah.
And I think that, what to me was, I remember distinctly, like, when the minute I started socially sharing my progress with my Facebook page, I started, like, again, I wasn't trying to build an audience or anything like that. I was more just trying to chronicle the journey. And I remember when I hit that 60% mark, 50% felt horrible, but 60% felt good. And every incremental step, every chapter, and as, you know, things started flowing and finishing, and the way I had built everything, trying to do the story arc up front and build out the character relationships, and the way I did my brainstorming and how I brought everything together, it all worked. I got to the end and I really didn't have to rewrite very much, if anything, in the middle. When I reread it for the first time with new eyes, I was actually really happy with the fact that it flowed really well. It was, you know, chronologically made sense. And again, it paid tribute to the technologies and the pop culture and everything that shaped my life. But the thing that got me was the fact that when I was done, I sent it, and I just remember going, wow, you did it. And again, good or bad or other, like, I've had a lot of people read it. A lot of people have given me, you know, positive reviews. I'm optimistic to write the next one. You know, but again, part of me is like, you know, this is my way of kind of closing the book on certain parts of my life. It's like, you know what, this is me kind of, you know, I don't need to think about that stuff anymore. I can focus on, you know, the next journey in my life, the next era, if you will. But the fact that I was able to do it, get it done, you know, most people don't get a chance to do this in their life or find an opportunity to do it. And I can say I've done it, and then I can maybe do it again later if everyone likes it. So.
Exactly, exactly. Well, with that in mind, it is time for shameless self-promotion, Ryan. Okay. Aside from the Dudes and Beer store, tell everybody where they can go get the book. Tell everybody where they can go follow the Ryan Rutan blog. Tell everybody where they can go to apply to be a part of the Cynac Red Team.
Oh, okay. Well, let me do the Cynac Red Team first, because that's actually easy. You can, if you're interested to look up to join the Cynac Red Team, we do have an open application process. So if you go to www.cynac, that's cynac.com/red-team. It'll have information there with an apply now link. So if you're interested, you can do that. You're also welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn. Just, you know, you can reach out, connect with me, and just say you heard here on Dudes and Beers. So we'll or Dudes with Beers.
Dudes and Beers.
Okay. But yeah, just, you know, reach out and you can ask me any questions there. I'm more than happy to do that. If you just type Cynac Red Team in Google, you'll, SEO being what it is, it should be number one.
Yeah, it pops right up. And where can they go to find your blog, all that kind of good stuff?
Yeah. So go there, forkthislife.com. If you go there, if you're curious and you're an interesting person, I'm working on a bunch of Easter eggs. So if you happen to poke around on the site, you might start seeing some fun stuff that I'm baking in. You mentioned war games earlier. I definitely have an homage to war games on the website right now. But again, if you go to Fork This Life, it has all the links. If you are in Kindle, Unlimited. I actually have the book will be there until the end of the year. So you can pick it up for free and read it for free until the end of the year. After that, I may remove it. Other than that, you go to Amazon for the paperback or Kindle. And then I think I just set up Smashwords, so I should be showing up on other platforms as well. But
fantastic. Fantastic. And may I say, I love the classic BBS feel of this site. It is so utterly classy. Great job. Great job. Oh, fantastic
site. It's still a work in progress, it's
fantastic book. My reading of it is still a work in progress, but what I have read so far, I'm not really one. My brother was somebody who was like a voracious novel reader. I read instruction manuals.
Same here.
Like, it was for me, reading a novel was hard. So whenever I find work from people like Graham Phillips, our guest, who writes these incredibly technical things about history in such a narrative form that it just carries you through it so fast, through some thick, thick material. And when you find someone like you that writes in such an easy to read way, it's not a hard work for the imagination to get through a book. It's typically pretty hard for a novel to really snatch me and pull me along the storyline rapidly. Yours has done that.
Wow. So well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
I have thoroughly enjoyed my read of it. It is a very, very, casual reading for such a interesting topic like this that is so technical. So, you've really done a great job with translating a lot of that for the common man.
Oh, well, thanks.
Yeah, most definitely. Thank you so much for taking the time this evening to really kind of demystify the world of hacking, and especially ethical hacking, when it comes to terms like that. So, we have been looking for somebody like that for a long time. I am so glad that we were able to have you on to discuss not only that, but also Fork This Life, the fantastic book that you have out in the first volume now, second volume to be released someday soon. So please do hold the line while we close things out here, Ryan. We'll be right back with you. And while you're online checking out everything from Ryan Rutan, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. That is where you can find the Dudes and Beer store, where you can find all the books from our guests like Stephen Myers. Even Ryan is in here. You can find movies like Money Machine by our guest, Ram Dennison. All kinds of fun stuff. dudesandbeer.com/store is the site that you want to visit, folks. Also, do not forget about the Knowledge Vault while you're there. That's where you can find all the great downloadable PDFs of declassified government programs like MKUltra, even PRISM. There's the entire PRISM PDF there. So if you want a really fun read, talking about things like this, go check that out. That was the Edward Snowden leak, folks. Thank you so much for always listening. We are going to be having an amazing episode 300 coming up very, very soon. Thank you for always tuning in, everybody. Make sure to take care of yourselves and your family during this wild, weird time. Until next time, we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. If you can't be good at it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets.
Being rebuilt.
For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.